The following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, and my special guest most weeks, Dan DuBose, CPA. Dan, are you on with us?
I'm on. Good morning, Nathan.
Very good. Good morning, it is. It feels great to be here in Houston here for the next few weeks, and we like this cold weather coming from the confines of Bangkok, where it's humid. Kind of like Houston most of the time, but not right now. Let me just elaborate on our disclaimer that you heard part of at the top of the show. You're going to hear assorted tax strategies. We may talk about a syndication or two today, the syndication math topic. And just because you hear something that sounds good, please check with your existing advisors, be it tax, legal, real estate, advisors, etc., to make sure that what you heard, one, is correct. Hopefully they understand the syndication space. And then secondly, that it applies, and most importantly, that it applies to your facts and circumstances. And if you still don't have someone that you're working with that understands how these strategies might apply to your facts and circumstances, please go to our website at beaplanner.com. That's BEAPLANNER.com. And you can fill out our forms. That's the second link from the right at the top. And then you can schedule a call with us, and Dan and I'll be happy to take a look at your facts and circumstances and tell you how we or private real estate partnership syndications might sync up with your objectives. By the way, Dan, why do we do real estate private partnership syndication, specifically multifamily? What's the intrigue or the allure to that specific niche of real estate?
A return on your investment?
That's one of them, but what about for all us old guys? Mature guys.
Planning?
Dan was choking on that adjective, wasn't he? Old. I would say it's because we don't have to get out of bed every morning to go run those old beat up Class C apartments that are going to be made beautiful as part of the syndication. I mean, that's the opportunity, right? Why do we buy beat up old apartments? It's like, why did Jesse James rob the banks, right? That's where the money is. And, you know, there's obviously, Class A buildings that will have a nice return on investment, but Class A would be the ones that we would buy because maybe we want to live in one of them, right, Dan?
Yeah.
So the Class C, you got to have some vision. You got to be able to see and the vision by what's that top line rental income going to look like pre and post the nice stainless appliances, maybe the wood like quote-unquote flooring that we're going to put in, the bark park, the covered or garage parking. You got to look past the asset as it sits there today, because if you were going to buy it pretty, there wouldn't be near as much upside on the rental income. Correct, Dan?
That's usually what we call a value add, isn't it?
That's exactly right, as opposed to a yield play, which, think about it, it's more like buying a T-bill, you know, treasury bond, where maybe it's already 92, 93, 98% occupied and it's got cash flows. And if we go that route, we're going to pay more and we don't have near the upside. And why do we like upside, Dan? Two reasons, right?
Return on your investment.
Well, that's one of them, but I was thinking specifically of the ability to refinance or to sell in the future. Maybe refinance several times before we sell, right? Depends on the market, depends on how successful we are in making the new story when it comes to net operating income, depends on what the cap rates are at the moment in the market. Right now, cap rates are trending up, which means the property is worth less. You pick a level of NOI, you apply an increasingly higher cap rate, the value of the property goes down. And so if we're a seller, we liked those 3.5, 4% cap rates. As a buyer, we might not have. But in any event, you know, right now the cap rates are trending upward, and I don't know how many transactions Dan and I have reviewed as of late that show buying a property today at maybe a 4.7, 4.75 cap rate, and lo and behold, we're going to sell it 3 years from now, maybe five, and it's the 4.75 cap rate still being used. I think that's totally unreasonable. Irrational would probably be the better word. What do you think, Dan? Just wild guess, where do we think interest rates are going to end up? Because I know it's not the same technically as a cap rate, but it sure has a lot to do with the cap rate that a buyer is going to be willing to buy at. So where do we think rates may tap out before they start heading downward again, based on what you've read and seen in the media?
What I've read and seen here of late is, you know, it could get as high as 7%. One guy even threw out an 8% number. I mean, in 1978, I bought a house at an 8.25 interest rate, and I thought I had just done a great thing, you know. But that was when things were very different. But, you know, we've seen this 2% interest rate. People really got hooked and used to that, so. And when we see a 4% or 6%, 5% interest rate, we get all excited nowadays, I think.
Boy, that's true. When did you say you were doing an 8 or 9%?
It was in 74, actually, when I bought my first house.
Yeah. Well,
8.25.
Yeah, I was, let me think, it was sometime a little bit later. I think I bought a home in, it was 85, maybe 86. Where by then the rates had gone up to about 12%, I think, is what we paid on that mortgage. And that wasn't where it ended. It actually went higher after that, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, you know, the cap rate is simply one of the variables that we look at. And,
is it not a major variable?
Well, it is when it's going up like it is. We didn't think we really focused more on equity multiple, which is still important, by the way, until fairly recently, because we started seeing this irrationality take place with these projected exit caps. And by the way, I've done some sensitivity analysis. I haven't put this out on our site yet. We'll be adding it here soon, where we look at the impact of a 4.75 estimated cap rate on exit or refi. Same concept, and I rent it out, raising it 0.5% all the way out to 6.75. So, you know, 4.75, 5.25. 5.75, et cetera, up to 6.75. And just to give you some idea, now, again, every transaction is different. You've got different sharing ratios between the lead partner. That's the partner that's running the partnership. They're the ones that locate the property. They find the debt for the property. They sign typically as a guarantor on that debt. You as a passive investor do not have to. And by the way, I guess I should have continued on with why we like these multifamily private partnership syndications, because you're not having to go on the debt. You don't have to guarantee the debt. You don't have to find the debt. Don't have to negotiate the debt. Just like you don't have to find the tenants, you don't have to negotiate with tenants. The lead partner or Sometimes we refer to him as the sponsor or the syndicator. There's a number of terms that are applied, but bottom line is, it's the one that's running the show, the one that's driving the wagon. And, you know, when you look at how you project how much they're going to return to you as part of this investment, I'm just going to give you an idea here. And again, there's variables between A and let's say E, if E was exit, or F for refi or finance, where a 4.75 that doesn't end up at 4.75, let's say it leaks over or goes up to 5.75. Well, in the example that I'm running, that I'm looking at 4.75, the passive investor was getting 57%, 58 almost, of their capital, their original investment back. And that's not uncommon, or it wasn't, 6 months to a year ago or more. And if it goes up 1%, that drops down to 37%. And then if it goes up another 1%, we're down to 22%. So we're talking about almost a third. I'd say, what is that, Dan? It's about 35% or so of what you might expect if you believed or fell for the 4.75 exit cap. And I'm not sure why. I guess the syndicators think, oh, everything's going to be nice and rosy again in the 3 to 5 year timeline. And I'm telling you right now, if we don't get a handle on the debt, the deficit that this country has, this exit cap's going to be a lot higher than what we're showing on this sensitivity analysis. It will be, well, it's hard to say, because if we don't get a handle on the deficit, we're going to see a depression, the likes of which, this country's never seen. When you can't pay the interest on the debt, which is where we'll be 2029 or 2030. And Dan, if you'll recall, the CBO study that we referenced, that's Congressional Budget Office, back in 2009, suggested that the tax brackets needed to go up, each of the three brackets at that point needed to go to 150%. And now, if you listen to folks like David Walker, the former comptroller, effectively the controller of the U.S. Back during the Clinton and Bush administrations, he's saying 200% now, because the deficit has gone from, I don't know, $8 or $9 trillion back in 2009 when the CBO issued that report, to now where we are $32 trillion. But more importantly, and this is always this is what the congressmen would always say when they would get asked, well, about a piece of legislation, well, aren't you concerned that the deficit is going higher and the percentage of our country's debt to our GDP is going up? And you would hear, oh, well, you know, we're nowhere near 100% of GDP, so we really don't have to worry. You know, as we borrow more, our GDP goes up. And so we're relatively in the same position as opposed to some country like Japan, where they're 300% of GDP, their debt. Okay, and that is bad. But you know what ours was last year, Dan? End of 2021? You remember the number?
About 130% of GDP, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. So now let's go back and look at who those congressmen were that were saying, oh, we're not worried, it's nowhere near 100%. Do you recall in the CBO's 2009 report to Congress what they thought, or when they thought we might cross that 100% threshold, Dan?
2030?
2040 to 2042 was the time frame. And so we not only crossed it, we may be at 250% by 2040 or 42, the way this crowd spends, right? Congress and our president, you know, our president is the type that forgets what he said yesterday. And when the Inflation Reduction Act passed, that would be the IRA 2022, he made the comment that, boy, we've just put a down payment on deficit reduction, because there was a $350 billion supposedly savings that he turned right around 2 weeks later and implemented or tried to implement the student loan forgiveness, which thankfully has had the brakes put on it by the judicial branch. And I'm not sure how permanent that is, but I would say that with a Republican House, we may be able to stave that off indefinitely. Which, by the way, having a Republican House probably bodes well on the Roth front as well, right, Dan? The Roth 401 and Roth IRA
front. Indeed it does. It's going to stave off that the rate increase at least for, you know, 2 years, maybe 4 years, maybe 8 years, some people say.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, obviously those rates we're worried about revert to the pre-Trump tax cut level at
if Congress does nothing.
That's right, or that's exactly right. If they do nothing, which hopefully nothing is better than, you know, when I hear that there's gridlock in Congress and there's not much chance you're going to pass any legislation, that is wonderful news, isn't it? That means they can't do any more damage in the short term, right?
Good news.
That's very nice news, and I'm not sure, you know, the if you said the Democrats had the advantage, like basically we're going to be about the same point, I believe, once all the recounts settle, although you got to wonder, it seems like most of the recounts, the Democrats, somehow they manage to win, you know, recounts or late counts, I guess it is. They're so much better at ballot harvesting than we are. They're just great farmers, you know, when it comes to ballots that support their candidates. But anyway, we're going to end up, it looks like, with about the same split. But, you know, the Democrats hang together. They've learned, let's pass it. Whereas the Republicans all have to beat their chest and carve out their turf. And I've often said that, you know, usually it's better. I think back to the Ronald Reagan, Tip O'Neill days. It's better when they have to work together. But, boy, that's all changed. You know, the bipartisan nature of Congress is almost non-existent. But anyway, so let's do this. Let's go ahead and take a break. We're not quite at the halfway mark, but before I pivot to a new topic, I'd like to go ahead and take a break. We'll be right back with more of the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross and Dan Dubose, CPAs.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com, Nathan at npross.com.
The Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, focuses exclusively on helping investors understand the current options for investing. The syndication arena has changed. You can now take advantage of direct online investing options without expensive upfront membership fees. Nathan Ross, CPA, discusses these options and more, including the math involved with partnership selection, reporting, and performance. On the Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, Sundays at 7 a.m. right here on KSEV.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome back to this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross and my guest, Dan Dubose, CPA. And Dan, we're going to pivot for a few minutes and talk more about some entities. We've kind of introduced the concept. We're going to review, if time permitting, two of the structures that we like, depending on whether we're dealing with a business owner or a operator within the real estate space. And, you know, I want to review just the general notion a bit of, you know, why we do entities, I guess, number one. And basically this subsection that we're going to be talking about is how entrepreneurs can save significant monies if they set up the preferred vehicle that we like is the LLC that's taxed as a partnership or reported as a partnership. Partnerships don't generally get taxed. They can create some tax for their owners. That would be the partners. But in any event, we think the LLC is an extraordinary vehicle for asset protection and tax savings. And let's talk a little bit about what asset protection is. You know, let's start off by understanding that in America, people can sue for anything, and they do, as an attorney once said. And as opposed to where I've been hanging out the last 3 years overseas in Thailand, there's not really much of a plaintiff's bar. And I'll never forget when I was over there probably for the first or second time, I saw an article in the paper where a young movie star had inadvertently run over a garbage collector. Inadvertently, of course. Self-defense, actually, is what he said. The first article that was in the Bangkok Post, and then a week later, I noticed, the first time it wasn't him. He didn't do it. Second article was it was self-defense. And by the third article, he had gone to the Buddhist equivalent of, traffic court, if you will, and had made merit with the family. And somehow it translated to $15,000 U.S. for that man's life that his family got paid. And I remember thinking, where were the lawyers? Well, there aren't any, or there's not any that sue for plaintiff-type actions, although that's changing. But I tell you what, in America, we don't even think about it. That's like the first thing you do. Well, the first thing that happens is the attorney you talk to checks to see if there's a malpractice or some kind of liability insurance in place, because if there's not, you're probably going to have to come out of pocket a bunch of money to handle that suit, which most people can't do. But if you got a good claim and you've got some liquidity on the other end, you can count on that lawsuit happening. And that's one reason I tell people, you know, insurance is good, but it's got its limits, and you can count on the suit. The lawsuit will happen if you've got liability insurance. That's whether you're an accountant or whether you're a property manager, whatever you are. So we like using leveraged up properties as a good informal type of insurance, because there's no attorney in Texas or any other state that wants a leveraged up piece of real estate as the payoff at the end of the day for them winning a suit. And by the way, the LLCs are or have what we refer to as charging order status, which means that at the end of the day, if the problem existed from outside the LLC, this wouldn't count. You know, let's say you had a property in an LLC and someone slipped and broke their arm or whatever, that LLC could be held responsible or held liable. I'm talking about you're the owner of the LLC, you're driving home today, and you inadvertently injure, maim, or kill someone. Well, then the lawsuit would be against you, unless for some reason your LLC assets were responsible. And so they would win the rights to your member interest in that LLC. However, they won't win the right to manage it. And therein lies the disconnect that most attorneys want to avoid. They don't want to win a piece of paper that says they get whatever you take out of the partnership, because you could still direct distributions theoretically and allocate income, although the winner of that piece of paper gets to pay your share of the income if it's taxable. So it's, the LLC is a good vehicle, assuming that everything happens outside the fence that it's around in terms of the assets that it protects.
Yeah, we're assuming here that everybody knows what an LLC is.
That's a good point, Dan. Thank you for slowing me down.
An LLC is a limited liability company. It's formed by the state, or formed by you through the state. It's a document you file with the state that says you have this entity. And you got to remember, this entity is not you, and you are not the entity.
Boy,
now, you may own and probably should own that entity, but it is separate and apart from you.
That is a great point, Dan, and I want to circle back to that, because I want us to talk about what happens after we form these entities. And you and I both all too often see clients that simply they're checking the box on some checklist. They got it a seminar, a webinar, or whatever, and boy, they don't understand the concept of alter ego and segregation of activities, finances, et cetera. Why do we care about asset protection? And again, lawsuits are the main reason. And when you realize that you can be sued by anyone at any time for any reason, even if you do the right thing or you do everything right, which you should, and we're going to talk about some of those things that need to be done right, and even if you're totally innocent, you can be sued. You ever been sued, Dan?
I have not, and I find that quite unusual from what I read. You know, there's a, you know, a statistic I looked up just because I wanted to know. This was in 2016. I remember it. There were 84 million lawsuits in state courts in 2016. Now, what is it now? That's 6 years ago. It's maybe double that. But one guy said that a person may be sued 7 times in his lifetime. Man,
well,
you got to really, I have not. And
yeah.
Knock on wood, I don't have any right here with me.
Yeah.
But it hasn't.
Well, I've been sued, and thankfully it ended in my overcoming said lawsuit. And what I learned, and you can tell me, who wins when typically there's litigation, Dan? Who are the only ones that consistently win? There you go. It's like the house in Vegas, isn't it? Same concept. And
of the lawyers in Texas, you know, some guy threw out the number 90,000. One guy said there's more lawyers than there are.
I think there's 90,000 in Harris County. And and I forgot the ratio, but Harris County was one of the, at least in Texas, one of the most prolific lawyer hotbeds, if you will. But anyway, you know, even when you do the right thing, we were sued by a plaintiff's lawyer. That this was back at the height of the last debt malaise, where there were a lot of lawyers that wanted to get in to the real estate game, and we had a lawyer that actually copied pleadings from another lawsuit, forgot to change all the names and addresses that related to that real estate. Oh yeah, no, it was a classic case of you know, throwing a grenade in to see who might settle, and we refused to settle. And it cost $50,000 to lawyers for a 9-day trial. And in any event, it's an interesting experience that I wouldn't suggest anyone spend the money to go through. Just take my word for it. You want to avoid it. And if we could have settled it for peanuts, we would have, just to avoid the legal costs. But these folks didn't understand that they were not going to get, as the proverbial, blood out of the turnip, because that 2008, 9, and 10 was a rough time for us real estate guys. But fortunately, that's my only experience with litigation And again, it had to do with real estate and disclosures, which we thought we did a great job, and we did. I mean, at the end of the day, we had a decision that we could have gone back to the plaintiff for our legal costs, but we wanted to be done with it. You just don't understand when you get in a trial setting, you have a jury that may have, and this is, I'm not casting aspersions at these occupations, but I just want to tell you, when you've got a hairdresser that's never bought a piece of real estate in their life, maybe a college student, they've got your future in their hands, right? In terms of you being able to prevail and communicate the facts in a fashion where they clearly see, hey, these folks weren't at fault, and thankfully we had that going for us. But anyway, so bottom line is, when it comes to litigation, as you've already pointed out, Dan, it's not if, it's when. And you said seven times was the average that the average person will get sued? Was it seven?
Well, statistically,
That's exactly what I was just looking out on Google. That's exactly what I'm seeing several sites say. And so let's move on. Real estate is a high liability risk asset generally. And in any event, you know, with high quality education, real estate investing can be high return, low risk. And, you know, we're not talking about return risk. We handle that pretty ably because in most cases we make money, but we mean liability risk. And since, you know, you've got environmental hazards, you've got interactions with tenants, vendors, suppliers, and others, all these are folks that might at some point choose to litigate. So in any event, let's give a few examples. You know, Nancy is a real estate agent. I apologize to any Nancys out there. I promise this is not about you. Nancy is a real estate agent and real estate investor that owns rental properties. She has no entity at all. These are just held personally, like so many of our clients. Right, Dan?
That's right.
And her real estate agent business went down. She couldn't pay her bills. This was probably, I'd have to look, I think it was back in 2009 or 10. Then someone was severely injured on one of her rental properties. So severe, the claim exceeded her high insurance limits. And insurance is a whole nother story that we could get into. But essentially, the negative result was legal actions from numerous creditors. She had to fork out, and this is a small number, $6,200 in legal fees. She had a $55,000 judgment against her properties for the severe injury. This totals $61,000, and I would suggest, again, she's getting off light if it was a significant injury. Insurance did not at all protect her from the creditors and did not reimburse her for the legal fees. Liability insurance only protected her from the severe property injury. So there again, that potentially could have been prevented with the proper structure, or at least part of it. I guess it depends on where these assets set. And if, in fact, someone was injured on one of her rental properties, well, then that one property, even if it had been in an entity, would be problematic. Now, they wouldn't be able necessarily to liquidate the entity to get to that property, so you would have some protection. But you could also be in a scenario that I see all too often where someone has four properties, they put them in one limited liability company, and now there's potential cannibalization, if you will, between the properties. And again, you know, the charging order would prevent liquidation, but you really would like to avoid that altogether. Here's another example that I like to use because, boy, I've seen this hundreds of times over the 20-plus years that I've worked with some of the real estate mentor platforms, investor platforms, what I refer to as the old school travel agent type platforms, like several we have right here in Houston. And for those of you that have joined those, you know the fees are significant, you know, $20,000 to $25,000. And you know that in most cases, most CPAs are going to tell you that that is not deductible because most CPAs don't join the Real Estate Mentor platforms. Correct, Dan? They don't see the value, perhaps. But bottom line is they look at this as education expense where, you know, if we wanted to go to law school and go pay, you know, the tuition, et cetera, we would, as accountants or as anything other than an existing lawyer who was maybe taking some continuing education, we wouldn't be able to write that off. And so, you know, we could, as CPAs, go attend a tax law seminar at one of the law schools, and we'd be able to deduct that expenditure. And so when we see these fees, and having joined a couple of these platforms, I know exactly what I'm paying money for, and I understand that it's a piece of it might be education, although if I already own rental property, I would suggest that it's continuing education. Would you agree with that, Dan?
I would agree with that.
Right. And let's assume that I didn't already own real estate. If you look at what you're getting, look at that membership, the fine print on what you're getting out of that organization, a piece of it, only a piece of it involves education. You're getting access to services, to consulting, to mentoring, to some of the groups do property visits where you get to tour the members' properties, and they share freely with you on the information about how they did it or didn't do it. You know, what works on this corner of Southwest Houston or Dallas or Phoenix versus what doesn't work. So you're getting a lot more than just education. And it's kind of like in our case as accountants, I'm a member of the AICPA, American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Well, part of what we get is education. Of course, in our case, it's continuing education, so we deduct that entire fee. But we're getting access to other resources within that group. You know, I get a heck of a deal on FedEx accounts and Hertz rental cars. And so all I'm trying to suggest is that a lot of these mentor platforms, if they're structured the way that the several are that I've been involved with, you're joining essentially a professional association of real estate investors. And I would tell you that if you don't have an understanding or your accountant doesn't have an understanding of that, you're leaving some major dollars on the table. And I guess I'm going to circle back and suggest to you that this education, and again, I'm going to go into this just real briefly, this example. James from Minnesota, I'm not sure how relevant that is to our story, but that's where the client was, deducted his business education courses on highly audited IRS schedules with no entity, no documentation, no anything. And, of course, what happened, Dan? What often happens in these cases?
It gets eliminated as an expense.
Well, yeah, by some additional scrutiny from third-party agencies, I believe, is where you were headed there, correct?
Yeah.
So accordingly, that return, or actually there were 2 years that were audited. One return got selected, and then the IRS went back an additional year. For 2 years of audits, he had to fork out a total, I think it was about $21,000, $22,000 in taxes, interest, penalties, and legal fees. Plus, I'm going to tell you, I've yet to meet the client that doesn't think an audit is incredibly stressful. And that's
not one.
Yeah, that's worth money. Think about what you can do with the $21,000 you're getting ready to have to cough up, right? And so, in any event, the LLC does not legitimize. I want to be clear. It doesn't legitimize, this type of audit loss or avoidance, I guess you would say. But bottom line is, I can't remember how it was. It wasn't, by the way, one of our clients. This client came to us later, and I'm pretty sure the deduction was just labeled real estate education. And that's the first mistake. I mean, you really need to present deductions like this in a fashion that, you know, it calls it what it is. And again, association expense or some of it would be education. We normally, again, if you don't own real estate and you come to us, we're going to not deduct part of that fee because it in its entirety, it's not deductible. There's IRS court cases directly on point with education. Now, I've seen no cases where the accountant involved didn't think or probably didn't understand, because most accountants don't join real estate mentor investor groups for whatever reason. We do because we want to invest in real estate, and we see the benefit of at times these platforms. We also see the lack of benefit, and we're happy to share those with you. Any of you that are thinking about joining a real estate mentor platform, no charge. I'll give you my two cents on why you might want to do it, and there are reasons to do it, and there's most assuredly reasons not to do it. And then, of course, there's reasons to do it, but keep your eyes and ears open to avoid some of the negatives that you might unwittingly fall into. Like, for instance, being told that you should liquidate your retirement funds so that you can control them as you invest in real estate. We know how to get access to your retirement funds. We don't liquidate them. We keep them in the pre-tax or Roth container that they already sit in, even if it's a big company. We know how to access them. If you live in the great state of Texas, you're married, filing joint, those are the two prerequisites. We can help you access those dollars and control their investment. So you decide who, when, where, and how much to invest with, and the benefits accrue back to your tax deferred entity or Roth entity, as the case may be. And it increases the wealth creation substantially over the next, well, rest of your lifetime. And by the way, for those of you that may not know, you know, I ask this question often. In fact, I've got a prospect right now that's 80 years old, and we discussed his situation the other day in some detail. And I was getting ready to end the call, and I said, oh, I forgot. I just need one more question answered. When do you plan on passing away? You know, that's kind of critical, you know, for what I'm looking at, trying to plan the future. And of course, he said, well, you know, my parents lived into their 90s. I think I'll do that. And I said, well, you know, the IRS has life expectancy tables that are used for things like required minimum distributions, you know, RMDs, which he was already familiar with, obviously, at age 80. And they think that most of us males in this day and age will live to 85 to 86, and the female population will be 87, 88. So for those of you that didn't know, that's what the IRS thinks. So anyway, Dan, let's pivot momentarily, because this, you know, the LLCM, we've just touched the surface. We'll come back next week with more of this, because you know, we want to give you, with the LLC structure, we want to give you financial privacy. We want it to provide some audit defense, because LLCs are taxed or reported as partnerships, don't seem to be audited as often. We want support for tax saving strategies, because a company typically can deduct certain things that you might not be able to on an individual return. We want to protect against things like environmental, lead, paint, radon, asbestos, etc., fair housing violations, even unintentional innocent ones. And but you know, you got to remember, insurance does not cover business disputes with those you deal with, legal fees and court costs, claims that exceed limits, claims that insurance companies say are not covered, financial privacy, IRS audit defense, environmental, fair housing, we already mentioned. And but the type of LLC structure that we use will protect you personally. It'll give you protection benefits that insurance does not or cannot, I guess, you depend on how you look at it. But that's for the operator. That's for someone that's actually operating a piece of real estate and is exposed in ways that investors, passive investors, may not be. And for that, we've got the ability to use a irrevocable grantor trust structure, which may also, and in fact, in most cases, includes the use of an LLC. And, we like this structure because it gives us the ability to involve family members. It gives us the ability to retain the tax benefits that flow through. And it doesn't involve, it's especially private because it doesn't involve a state filing. Does the LLC include a state filing, Dan, that limited liability company that you
referred to?
You
must have a formation document on file with the state that you incorporate or that you establish in.
You form, I guess, right?
Right. And, yes, you form.
And what's the tangential result of that? I wouldn't call it a benefit, but what do you have to do? We just went through that last week with the deadline of November 15th. What do we do, Dan, for at least a day or two?
I don't understand the question, Nathan. I'm sorry.
We filed franchise tax and public information. How could you forget that pain?
The pain of the did. Franchise.
That's right. You already have recovered, apparently. You're ready for next year. In any event, a limited liability company, even a single member one, is obligated to file that annual report and pay tax if you exceed, I've forgotten the indexed amount. What is it, $1.1 million or more, Dan, in gross revenues?
Right.
But the trust that we like is not formed with the state of Texas, unless, again, there's an LLC component that would be. And essentially, what we're going to put in that trust is your personal investments, savings accounts, securities, annuities, maybe some land that's, benign when it comes to liability. We don't want anything in this trust. We're not going to put your boats or your airplanes or your swimming pools in this type of vehicle because we don't want something from the inside jeopardizing those assets. But things like ownership interest in your entity. So if you're going to invest in these real estate private partnership syndications that we like, this would be a structure that we would use to hold those types of assets. And there is no business purpose requirement. There's no legal or tax problem in holding personal use type assets in a trust. And in any event, there are a few things we try to avoid. We don't want to put any investment real estate that's already or might already have some other estate entity planning. We need to look at that before we move towards moving those or conveying those to a trust. Dan, let's pivot once again. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. It's not much time, but let's talk about another syndication. I believe it's fairly new, if I recall. And all I want to do is hit the highlights to kind of show how the numbers are getting a little bit weaker on real estate private partnership syndications, but they still are way beyond what you're going to do with alternative uses for your money. And you want to pick up with that discussion?
Here's one that we looked at this week. It's a 320 unit. It's on the east side, on the east coast area. Can you get specific on it, Nathan, in this deal? I don't know.
Well, I noticed the equity multiple over 5 years was 1.8, which that's significantly less. But I also noticed that the
cash on cash of 5.5%.
That's right, and that's where I was headed. You know, when you compare that to your money market account, it's obviously a higher rate of return. And I don't know. I've forgotten if the T-bills, I think they have reached up into that space,
yeah,
right?
Bonds are in the 4%.
Yeah, but how much upside is there on a T-bill unless the rates go a lot higher, right?
That's right.
So, you know, when you look at this, and then you look at the sponsor, you know, this is a 9x repeat out on CrowdStreet.com. It's a 9-year repeat, 10-year sponsor with $1 billion+ in transaction experience. And they've got 3 properties currently in that current market. And so, you know, when you again, compare this to where your money's sitting, and by the way, unless you're getting about 12% or so on your money, you've already lost purchasing power compared to putting it into something like this that might appreciate 12% or more, right? That's the hope with these hard assets. And, you know, in this case, I think the IRR, you have that handy, Dan? I'm not looking at
13.4.
Yeah. So at least for now, and see, the thing about real estate that's, you know, a nice corollary benefit is that inflation typically involves rents going up, right, Dan? And admittedly, your expense load's also going up, but at least you've got the ability, particularly if you're the one running the show, to increase rental rates as the market will bear. But in any event, you know, again, the reasons we invest in multifamily is, you know, it's hard assets. We've got more flexibility on things like rental rates and inflation. It's not that we're unaffected. It's just that typically we get some of that lift when rates go up. And, of course, with debt structures that are longer term, we avoid the big one. I mean, the interest expense is usually the single biggest expense item. And depending on the debt structure, I know we've got a client, Dan, that just sold 6 months after they had refinanced, had a 10-year term, and that actually got them a premium from a buyer. The buyer paid all the closing costs, and there were some that were, you know, somewhat high. Of course, you know, assuming the debt had cost to them, but it was worth it because it was refinanced. I guess it was actually more than 6 months ago. It was about a year and a half ago when the rates were still down in the high threes, low fours. Okay, we're at the end of this week's show. We've got less than a minute left. Thank you for listening today. If any of you would like to consider working with us, go to baplanner.com and fill out those intake forms and schedule a call. Dan, thanks for joining me. We look forward to next week. Same time, same station.
Thank you, Nathan.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in next Saturday at 5 for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEV.